We tried to reach Phyllis Chesler earlier in the program, and we had some difficulties, although we have worked that out, so we do that segment now. Again, 20 years ago and in love, Phyllis Chesler embarked on an adventure that lasted more than a half century. Shortly after arriving in Afghanistan with her Afghan bridegroom, the authorities took away her American passport, and she became the property of her husband's family. Drawing upon personal diaries, Chesler recounts her ordeal, the nature of gender apartheid, and her new family's attempts to convert her from Judaism to Islam. Chesler nearly died, but managed to escape and return to America. Her memoir is An American Bride in Kabul. Chesler is an emerita professor of psychology and women's studies at City University of New York, a fellow at Middle East Forum, and at the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy. An American Bride in Kabul won a 2013 National Jewish Book Award, and she'll be speaking at a Jewish Federation of Northeastern New York event on Wednesday, the 6th of May, in Schenectady. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Phyllis Chesler to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much.
It is my pleasure to be with you. I actually was there more than 50 years ago, not 20, I wish. And I think I'm speaking in Albany, not Schenectady. Just FYI.
Okay. So when I said that you were 20 years old, is that true?
That is true.
Okay,
that's true.
That
I'm
was,
sorry.
No, that's
that was
okay.
20 years ago.
And the information I have is that you are in Schenectady, but I will look that up. Because
okay.
On the website it says you were at the Schenectady, but I will try to find that out while I'm talking to you.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Okay. So, what brings you to really tell this story? As you say, it was many years ago. So, what was it about the story that you wanted to tell, and really the your maturing that says, okay, this is my story, and this is what I want to share with people.
Good question. Afghanistan, where I was held captive, prisoner, unexpectedly. My American passport removed from me, and I became the citizen of no country and the property of a very large, wealthy, polygamous Afghan family, is the same country that sheltered bin Laden and his al-Qaeda has been, and its spin-offs are holding the entire world, all citizens, hostage. And I found that was a very eerie coincidence, and it was a teachable moment, so to speak. And I had lived in Purda and in a harem. My mother-in-law had three wives, something I knew nothing about, and I understood the nature of Islamic gender and religious apartheid long before the Taliban arose, long before Al-Qaeda arose. So I felt that this was something that I had to share, whatever the lessons were that I learned about the very wild, wild East, with his great charm and hospitality and physical beauty, coupled with enormous illiteracy, poverty, superstition, and endemic barbarism, not caused by Western imperialism or colonialism.
When did you start to understand fully those lessons of what you had learned?
For the first decade, I didn't. I didn't have words for the kind of beating of female servants by my mother-in-law, or the women in burqas who were mistreated on public buses. I was shocked. I was horrified. I was frightened. I began to use the word patriarchy. I didn't use the word misogyny. It took some years for me to realize that I'd been very privileged to endure this and to survive. I got very ill. Most Westerners who travel to the Wild East get dysentery. I got dysentery. I got hepatitis. It's just in the nature of the adventure. And I began to comprehend that I understood, that I could look at the world through Eastern eyes. I'll give you an example. You would think, my God, the servants who were being cursed and beaten, why don't they leave, you know? No, because their greater fear is being fired so that they will lose the room and board and the leftover foods and the pittance of a salary upon which their extended family in the provinces depend. That's something I would never have understood were I not a prisoner and a witness. And there are many other such lessons, including my husband, my Afghan prince is what I dub him, was exceedingly sophisticated and charming and well-spoken, and his English was flawless. And I had no idea that he would deceive me, that he would betray me, that he would turn out to have another personality. This is very standard. It's pro forma. When you marry a man who's nothing but loving and filled with courtesies in the West, who seems westernized, when you return to his country, he becomes a man of his country. And without prior warning, this is a great blow. Also, the conditions of living with women only and not being able to go out except with a male escort and with a female relative. I was a young American kid wearing jeans and sneakers or ballet slippers. I didn't understand this.
Right. And through that understanding, I mean, again, that comes eventually of understanding it. But how does it have a fundamental, do you look at how it fundamentally changed you?
Yes, I think that it made me the firebrand feminist that I became in America. I think it kept me as a feminist whose concerns are with women's rights globally and who sees the struggle for women's rights in America as part of, and in contrast to, women who are forced as children into marriage, who are genitally mutilated, who are forcibly veiled, who are forced into polygamous unions, and who are unkilled. So that I'm not saying that women don't have problems in America, serious problems, but in context, globally, the women now suffering, an extreme example, under ISIS, simply doesn't compare with many of the serious complaints that American feminists have been raising. So I've remained someone concerned with universal human rights. I'm not a multicultural relativist. On the other hand, the fact that there are shelters for battered women in Kabul, in Herat, in Afghanistan, is only possible because of American boots on the ground. The minute we leave, the women will be killed. And the question, as Americans, is how much blood and treasure do we want to expend toward this very noble end?
When, let's see, I have two more minutes with you, so I wanted to follow up on that. But I also want to get into, because you have another book that has come out since the book you're going to be discussing, and that is The New American, The New Anti-Semitism. And I'm curious as to, because this was a book that had existed and you updated it, correct?
Yes.
So what is...
Together with a new book just coming out in days called Living History on the Front Line for Israel and the Jews, 2003 and 2015. And the connection, by the way, is I was pressured to convert to Islam every day by my mother-in-law.
Right.
And I made it a point to look into the history of the Jews of Afghanistan when I was writing this book, and I discovered to my horror that they had been overnight impoverished together with the Hindus, who had been the country's equivalent of bankers for many, many centuries. Overnight impoverished, and then a bank for Muslims by Muslims only was created by a former king, Nadir Shah, and my father-in-law was one of the three men tapped to run it. Which means that the impoverishment of the Jews is what, and therefore the wealth of my husband's family, who were in no way at fault, led to his ability to study in America for more than a decade and meet me.
Mm.
And so I think that chapter is fairly sensational because it's Nazi alliances that took place and extreme suffering on the part of the Jews and the Hindus of the country. A country that was once Buddhist, that's forgotten. Remember the destruction of the Buddhas of Bamiyan by the Taliban. There were hundreds, thousands of monasteries, Buddhist monasteries. And when Islam converted by the sword, which is what Islam does, they were destroyed. And all infidel religions were under siege, lived at risk. And that, too, is true of so many Muslim countries today, where there's persecution of Christians beyond belief, and where the Jews have been pretty much driven out of Muslim countries some time back.
Phyllis, we are unfortunately out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us. You're going to be speaking at a Jewish Federation of Northeastern New York event on Wednesday, May 6th. It is in Schenectady. We have that confirmed by the people who are handling it. So it
I'm
is in
amazed.
Schenectady.
They told me Albany.
It's Congregation Agadat Akim in Schenectady. And you can find out more information by going to jewishfedny.org, jewishfedny.org for more information. Phyllis, thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.